Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
The notion that evolution is based on more ruthlessly outcompeting your enemies, your competitors, I mean, that's nothing but corporate capitalism projected onto the natural world.
That's the voice of author Derek Jensen. On this week's show, Sylvia speaks to Derek Jensen regarding the contradictions between industrial capitalism and the environmental movement, and who citizens should show solidarity with if we are to move society forward in a healthy way. So stay tuned.
We are very privileged to be joined by Derek Jensen. Derek Jensen is a prolific author. He is a philosopher, a teacher, and a radical activist, the winner of many awards. He's got several books, seven of which I've read. I'm very privileged to have him on my program today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Now, Derek, I feel that we live in a world that, you know, this notion of survival of the fittest sort of frames and legitimizes all kinds of oppression, imposing a natural, you know, administrative hierarchy, a political hierarchy that, you know, we are told we are all sort of consensus to, you know, we're all agreeing to this narrative that is founded on this naturalness that, you know, it just, this is just how things are. Can we talk a little bit about what this hierarchy means to the living world when the voices of the rivers, the forests, the mountains are silenced when seen simply as resources?
Well, I think this is something that essentially every oppressive system attempts to do, is to naturalize its oppression so that it's inevitable. So it's not that the Nazis hated Jews. Instead, it's that from the perspective of the Nazis, they had themselves convinced that the Jews are actually inferior and need to be, in fact, they're a problem that needs to be solved. And thus, they're not actually committing atrocities, but they're doing everyone a favor by doing their behavior. And in fact, there were Nazis who, I don't remember if it was Himmler or someone, who talked about the great sacrifice that the Nazis were making in taking on this terrible task. So they were doing this great sacrifice by taking on this very difficult thing. So that's one example of it. Another example of it is you know, the oppression of women, that men are naturally superior to women, or men are naturally better at certain things, which, what do you know, just end up being things for which you get paid a lot more. And, you know, we saw that with Lawrence Summers saying that the reason there aren't more women in math is because men's brains work better. We have different brains, and my brain just happens to work a little bit better than your brain that way. You know, it doesn't really matter whether you are talking about a god that just happens to be of your gender and of your, you know, my gender, actually, and my race and my species, or whether we're talking about a selfish gene that makes it so we all act completely abominably and destroy communities. It's still naturalizing the oppression. You know, we talked about this before, that you know, in many ways, the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners would perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And, you know, I've been having this really interesting conversation recently with an epidemiologist about evolution and about viruses and about all sorts of really interesting things, that some of which I didn't know before. And he's a very, very smart person, and the one place where we're disagreeing so far is that he was saying to me that evolution can't think long-term, and it's all based on extreme short-term advantage. And I, of course, really disagree, that I think that those creatures who've survived in the long run have survived in the long run, and you don't survive in the long run by destroying your surroundings. You survive in the long run by actually improving your habitat. So I actually think that evolution is based on not survival of the fittest, but as Dolores Chappell said, survival of the fit. It's how well you fit into your surroundings. So salmon make forests a better place simply by their existence. And it's a win-win situation for everybody. The salmon do better, the forests do better, the bears do better, the insects do better, the ravens do better, the eagles do better, the bears do better. I don't know if I mentioned them already. The trees do better. And that's how evolution, how do we think that the world became so wild and fecund and gorgeous in the first place? It was through everybody living and dying and making the world a better place by their mere lives. But the notion that evolution is based on more ruthlessly outcompeting your enemies, your competitors, that's nothing but corporate capitalism projected onto the natural world. And once again, this is really, really important, because if the oppressors can get you to perceive the oppression as natural, and of course this was in slavery too, and it has been in slavery, that the reason it was okay for the whites to enslave the Africans was that, there were scientific reasons, there were biblical reasons, they had all sorts of justifications, all of which were, of course, nothing but justifications. Robert J. Lifton told me this great thing about how before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to convince yourself that what you're doing is actually a benefit. So like I said about the Nazis, they weren't actually killing Jews from their perspective. They weren't committing genocide. What they were doing is purifying the Aryan race. Or what, right now, capitalists are not destroying the planet. They are developing natural resources. And, there was an article recently about, titled, it was in some Southwestern newspaper, maybe the LA Times, it was titled, Destroying the Planet to Save It. And it was about putting in these huge solar fields in the desert and how they were saying, gosh, it's so difficult because we have to, we have to destroy this desert in order to save the planet. It's like, actually, no, because the electricity is being generated for industry. It's not being generated for the planet. You're not saving the planet.
I was just saying how beautiful the connections you make, because in many ways it's recognizing the inequality in our relationships that enables that kind of logic to permeate and to maintain this way of thinking. But I'm wondering if, what if the purpose of our life is not to dominate? If maybe just like nature, we are also meant to coexist, through reciprocity, through sharing and being, not adapting to new ways of harm and new ways of violence, but rather adapting to the limitations of our environment. Can you talk a little bit about what would a culture without this kind of administer violence that it's imposed through bureaucracies or whatever you want to call them? There's all this institutionalized way of seeing ourselves and very rigid ways of knowing ourselves, because this is what science has told us or this is what school has told us. How do we break out of it? How do we reimagine ourselves? How do we remember what we have forgotten?
I think that there are as many ways to do that as there are individuals. And I don't know how you work, but a lot of times the way I change is through sort of an interplay of emotional experience and intellectual exploration, by which I mean, I can get a feeling, it's like something's not right. This doesn't really make sense to me about the, that I don't believe that all of life is this terrible competition. And so it's not setting right for me. So I need to think about it. And then I can articulate my way forward, and articulate, I read other people and I talk to people and I get a framework that starts to make more sense, and then I go out into the world and I test it to see if it makes sense, and I see how it feels, and then the feelings can catch up to the intellectualization, And then sometimes the feelings can move a little bit further out. It's like, okay, so now I'm comfortable with this. Now I can move it a little bit further out, and then further, and then further. So for me, it's a combination of experience and what feels right in my gut, and dreams. And, you know, I can have a dream that can help me. I won't understand the dream, but it'll make like, oh, this makes more sense. And then I have to try to understand the dream, and reading, you know, purely intellectual or logical discussions can help me to then make sense of the non-logical dream. And so for me, it's that interplay. And then also, frankly, the bottom line for me is, you know, we talk, you know, to go back to that new friend that I'm having a discussion with about, who said that evolution doesn't think long-term and can't allow something to think long-term. I just look at the world and I look at the results. I mean, for me, I know this is an economic phrase, but it's always there. It's like, what's the bottom line? And the bottom line is this culture, this way of looking at the world is killing the planet. And that's obviously maladaptive. And so if it's maladaptive, it's probably wrong and probably factually inaccurate. You know, we have the Talawa Indians lived where I live now for at least 12,500 years. And, you know, sort of a scientific mechanist or mechanistic scientist could say, well, gosh, they were obviously, when they did salmon welcoming songs, the salmon couldn't hear the songs. They could say, you know, if they were singing to the salmon or praying to the salmon or praying about the salmon, that was all nonsense. But the truth is, they lived here for 12,500 years, and the place was a paradise. And the dominant culture has been here for less than 200 years, and the place is trashed. So, and you then have the gall to say that their perspective is wrong? Well, this perspective is maladaptive. You know, I read this really interesting, I was reading about plant intelligence recently, and you know, I've thought about this a lot over the years. I was thinking more about it. So there's some really cool stuff I'm reading. And one thing I was reading was saying that the best definition of intelligence is to figure out actions. I mean, how do my actions now affect my future well-being? And these people were using those as definitions of intelligence, and on those definitions, plants are intelligent, that they will make, it's very interesting stuff, plants will make decisions as to where to branch out based on future conditions in the forest as to where the branch would be most effective. So they can predict where the sun is going to be in a few years and grow a branch out to that place. So they're actually making decisions, once again, based on, and there are plants that decide to bloom or not bloom. Some of them that bloom very frequently can make those decisions years in advance based on conditions. So it's very interesting stuff. And then I'm contrasting that to myself, and I'm thinking, okay, my grandfather had diabetes, and he died of bladder cancer because of eating artificial sweetener every day. Back in the 60s, he died. And my mom has diabetes, and so I knew that I had a genetic predisposition to diabetes, and did that stop me from eating four baked potatoes at every meal? Did that stop me from eating bunches of ice cream through my 30s? Did this stop me from, and then I recently was diagnosed with diabetes, and it's like, wow, I was not actually showing any native intelligence. You know, we determine intelligence by whether current actions are going to determine future well-being. And, you know, honestly, when I look around, you know, I don't see under this definition, the dominant culture is really not, I'm not seeing any signs of intelligence whatsoever, frankly.
Yeah. You know, I was reading the book, The Price of Inequality, and the writer points out that not only is this idea that we're doing better is, you know, flawed, because in many ways, when they do all kinds of expectancy research, life expectancy, for instance, in the U.S. is 78 years compared to 83 in Japan or Australia. And the U.S. comes 40th, just below Cuba. You know, infant mortality is still higher in the U.S. than in other developing countries. And so we have to ask the question, where is this industrialized culture leading us to, when what we see is the constant promotion and maintenance of a culture of violence. You know, so I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the relationship between the capitalist system then and the world that it's intent on living on the principle of coexistence, of reciprocity. Can the two coexist? The evidence so far, I would argue, is no. So how do we move away and create new relationships?
I was kind of hoping that you would end your question with, is capitalism compatible with that, you know, either life-affirming or reciprocal relationships? And I was going to then, just because we've done a lot of interviews, I was going to sort of tease you by giving the answer that is every interviewer's nightmare, which is no, and then just shut up. And, you know, they're not compatible, and just leave it at that. But you went on to ask the more difficult question, which is, what do we do about that? How do we, I mean, part of what we have to do is, I was talking to a friend of mine today who is a doctor who, one of the things he's also an environmentalist, and one of the things he says all the time is there is a standard protocol when you're doing medicine, which is the first step. Correct prognosis is the first step toward effective treatment, a first step toward cure. And I think that one of the things we have to do is to do the correct prognosis. And as he said when I was talking to him today, you have to take a history, you have to look at what the current situation is. And this is one of the things that, I mean, Paul Kingsnorth talks about how there's a real problem with a lot of environmentalism these days, because he asks, when did environmentalism become not about protecting wild places, but instead about finding ways to make capitalism last longer? And I think that's a tremendous point, and it's very, very important. And when people talk about sustainable capitalism, I think that those people have a lot to answer for, because they're completely wrong, and they're pushing us into dead ends. And it's the same when people talk about, you know, sustainable wind energy. I mean, industrialism, civilization itself, but especially industrialism, has never been sustainable and will never be sustainable and can never be sustainable on a functional level. If this culture is killing the planet, the least we can do is tell the truth. And so a lot of environmentalists are lying to us, are lying to all of us, and they're lying to themselves. And that's not helpful. It's not helpful. It's not helpful on a personal level. You know, I've got Crohn's disease, and I could pretend, I could say, oh, I don't really have a disease, I just have diarrhea that goes on and on and on. And that's not helpful. That's not helpful at all. In fact, it's really harmful.
In your book, The End Game, Volume 1, you actually tell us exactly your premises for the book. And one of them, premise 14, you talk about that how from birth on, you know, we are enculturated into this, you know, this notion of hate, you know, for life, to hate the natural world, hate the wild, hate the animals, hate women, hate children, hate our bodies. We've been living in a culture that, rather than face that diagnosis of not just the symptoms of hate, you know, the symptoms of embodying violence as part of the culture, but the actual cause that permeates that culture. And you say that, you know, to love does not imply pacifism. What do you mean by that? And because I think that love has always been proposed as the solution to all our problems. Mandela loved the world, and so he forgave. But no one asked why we didn't forgive the debt of the South African people, and so giving them an equal footing. No one asks, you know, why we don't forgive, you know, the debts of other countries. And so, to me, this simplified notion of just love and things will right themselves doesn't seem to do it. So can we talk in closing? We only have about 4 minutes, but if you can.
Well, I think it depends on what we mean by love. I mean, when I think about love, I think about a mother bear. And if someone were to, what would happen if there's a baby bear, and there's a mother bear right next to it? What would happen to you if you walked in and started punching the baby bear in the face? What do you think the mother bear would do?
Well, I think that a mother bear would attack me if I attacked his baby.
So does that mean that the mother bear doesn't love her child? I mean, for me, love implies that you're going to act to defend your beloved. And if you don't act to defend your beloved under many circumstances, I don't know that that's love. And the reason I have to put in the weasel words about under many circumstances is I am not implying that, you know, a woman who was in World War II, who was standing next to her child, who was faced with SS machine guns, needs to rush them. I mean, there may be nothing she can do at that point except for hold her child and attempt to give the child a lifetime's worth of love in 5 seconds. That's very possible too. And I know that there were American Indians who, I'm thinking of specifically of some Central and South American ones, who were being enslaved by the Spanish. And what they would do is the mothers would take their children and they would jump off a cliff with their children because they didn't want their children sent to the mines. And that can be an act of love too. But the point is that much of the problem is we don't perceive the world as existing. We don't perceive octopi as being wonderful, beautiful, extraordinary beings with lives just as precious to them as yours is to you and mine is to me. It's like makes me so angry. Every single article that I read about some species going extinct has to immediately switch over to the economic effects of this. But it's so narcissistic and so dreadful. There are lots of articles about how the oceans are acidifying, and within one sentence, they always have to jump over to, wow, this is really harmful for the aquaculture, for the oyster farms that are in the ocean. It's like, forget the oyster farms. This is the whole ocean we're talking about. This is life on this planet. And so what I mean by all that, love does not imply pacifism, is everything in this culture teaches us to identify with the oppressors, and what we're supposed to do is to love our enemies. Well, screw that. What we need to do first is love the victims. And if there's any love left over, once you love the victims, then that can go over to the oppressors or to anybody else. But actually, frankly, I'm not cared about, you know, it's a bit late in the game to be worried about the emotional well-being of those who are killing the planet. Once again, my loyalty is 100% with the victims of this culture. And you know, so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we need to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And part of what that includes is breaking your identification and your loyalty with the system and making your identification with the victims of the culture, with the oppressed. And once you do that, everything else starts to fall into place.
Thank you so much. That was beautiful. My guest is Derek Jensen. His book, he's got many books. You can read his reader, the Derek Jensen reader. But tell our audience very quickly, in 2 seconds, how they can access your books, how they can reach your work.
Well, I've got a website, derekjensen.org, DerrickJensen.org. And the book should be available anywhere. And thank you. You always ask such wonderful questions. I'm always honored to be on your program.
Thank you again for being with us.
To finish out the show, I'm going to play a short clip by Noam Chomsky, which closely relates to the interview that Sylvia just did with Derek Jensen.
Modern industrial civilization has developed within a certain system of convenient myths. The driving force of modern industrial civilization has been individual material gain, which is accepted as legitimate, even praiseworthy, on the grounds that private vices yield public benefits in the classic formulation. Now, it's long been understood very well that a society that is based on this principle will destroy itself in time. It can only persist with whatever suffering and injustice it entails as long as it's possible to pretend that the destructive forces that humans create are limited, that the world is an infinite resource, and that the world is an infinite garbage can. At this stage of history, either one of two things is possible. Either the general population will take control of its own destiny and will concern itself with community interests, guided by values of solidarity and sympathy and concern for others, or alternatively, there will be no destiny for anyone to control. As long as some specialized class is in a position of authority, it is going to set policy in the special interests that it serves. But the conditions of survival, let alone justice, require rational social planning in the interests of the community as a whole, and by now that means the global community. The question is whether privileged elites should dominate mass communication and should use this power as they tell us they must, namely to impose necessary illusions, to manipulate and deceive the stupid majority and remove them from the public arena. The question, in brief, is whether democracy and freedom are values to be preserved or threats to be avoided. In this possibly terminal phase of human existence, democracy and freedom are more than values to be treasured. They may well be essential to survival. Thank you.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.